The UK has the largest network of double tax treaties in the world, with agreements having been signed with over 100 countries. A double tax treaty basically does as it says on the tin. It eliminates a double charge to tax where income is taxable in both countries under the domestic laws applicable in each of those countries. The terminology used when talking about double tax treaties refers to a country as a contracting state, i.e. a state contracting with another state with regard to the elimination of double taxation. Double tax treaties also deal with other issues such as tax evasion and non-discrimination. Many double tax treaties, but not all, follow the OECD Model Convention. Let us first look at Chapter 1, the scope of the OECD Model Convention. The scope of each convention applies to persons, i.e. people who are taxable, and the taxes themselves. A person is basically any person who is resident in either of the two contracting states. This is given by Article 1. Article 4 defines residence, and we will look at this shortly. The scope of the treaty is limited, however, where arrangements have been entered into which abuse the treaty provisions in order to gain a tax advantage. The definition of the taxes included under the OECD Model Convention is given by Article 2. Let us turn to the definition of residence, as given by Article 4. This article contains a tiebreaker clause, which basically says that where, under the domestic law of each country, an individual company is resident in both contracting states, the treaty definition of residence will apply, and, for treaty purposes, an individual company can only be resident in one of the contracting states, not both. As far as a company is concerned, residence is defined as the place of effective management. This is where the key management and commercial decisions of the company are taken. The most important question to ask here is, where do the directors make their decisions? The treaty makes it clear that there can only be one place of effective management at any one time, although there may be more than one place of actual management. It is the effective management which is important here. If we recall from an earlier chapter in this module, the UK definition of residence is based on management and control. However, it has been acknowledged as far back as 1977 that the UK definition of management and control is basically the same as effective management for double tax treaty purposes. We will now turn to the definition of a permanent establishment, as given by Article 5 of the treaty. Basically, a permanent establishment is any fixed place of business. What is useful about the treaty is that, unlike UK legislation, in many cases, it actually goes on and gives us examples as to what is and what is not a fixed place of business. Within the treaty, a permanent establishment includes a place of management, a branch, an office, a factory, a workshop, and a mine, oil well, quarry, or any other place of extraction of natural resources. The treaty then goes on to state that the following are not permanent establishments. These include premises used for the storage or display of goods as an end in itself, premises used for the purchasing or collection of information only, premises used for preparatory or auxiliary work. And, of course, any combination of these three items will also be excluded from the definition of a permanent establishment. Let us look briefly at agents. An agent that actually concludes contracts on behalf of an entity will amount to a permanent establishment. However, an agent simply acting as a broker or commission agent will not give rise to a permanent establishment in a contracting state. We will now turn to the taxation of income under the treaty. This is dependent on the type of income. First, we will consider property income. Property income will be taxed in the state in which the land is located, as given by Article 6 of the Convention. As far as business profits are concerned, these are taxed based on the location of the permanent establishment, as given in Article 7. The definition of a permanent establishment, of course, is given in Article 5. The treaty makes it clear that only the profits of the permanent establishment will be taxed in that particular contracting state. And the treaty sets out the method of computation of those profits. Basically, the permanent establishment is treated as a separate entity, and the arm's length approach used in transfer pricing is applied to its dealings with other parts of the enterprise which it is part of. Next, we consider dividends. Both states will be affected with regard to dividends because, of course, dividends are paid out of company profits, which are taxed in one state and may well be received by somebody resident in another contracting state. The treaty accepts that both contracting states will be affected here, but does impose maximum withholding tax rates. This is the amount of tax that may be withheld by the contracting state in which the corporate profits are taxed. Where the recipient owns at least 25% of the ordinary share capital of the company, the maximum withholding tax that may be applied is 5%. For other situations, the maximum withholding tax rate goes up to 15%. Let us consolidate this by looking at an illustration. Here we have the United Kingdom and a company resident in the UK called Torrance Limited. Then we have the rest of the world. And somewhere in another part of the world, we have another company, Parnevik SA. Parnevik SA is a wholly owned subsidiary of Torrance Limited. Parnevik SA pays a dividend of £95,000 to Torrance Limited, and there is a double tax treaty in place, in line with the OECD Model Convention, between the UK and the foreign country. Consequently, the maximum withholding tax that can apply to this dividend will be 5%. Therefore, if the other country decides that it wishes to withhold this amount of tax, the gross dividend will be £95,000 multiplied by 100 over 95, giving us £100,000. The withholding tax is 5% of the gross dividend, i.e. £5,000. Let us now take a look at interest. Interest is taxable in the country of residence of the recipient, as given by Article 11. However, it may also be taxed in the contracting state in which it arises. Again, the treaty imposes a maximum withholding tax rate, this time of 10%. Note, this maximum rate will only be available if the recipient is the beneficial owner of the interest. Article 11 permits an adjustment from interest under the thin capitalization rules, only where the interest rate is excessive. Consequently, no account is taken as to whether the amount of the loan itself is excessive. This particular point is dealt with in Section 808A of ICTA 1988. Consequently, the UK generally reserves the right within newly agreed treaties to take account of the amount of the loan with regard to thin capitalization rules before signing up to a particular treaty. We will now turn to royalty payments. Royalty payments are generally taxed based on the residence of the recipient. However, they may also be taxed on a permanent establishment within another contracting state. It is the permanent establishment rule that takes priority, and any royalty payment will be treated as part of the business profit. If there is no permanent establishment in existence, then the second rule will apply, and the royalties will be taxed in the country of the company or individual in receipt of them. As with interest, this rule will only apply if the recipient is the beneficial owner of the royalty. As far as royalties are concerned, they include the following: copyrights, films, patents and trademarks, software licenses, but not the right to copy software onto a user's system, and the ordering and downloading of goods from the internet, but only if this is for commercial exploitation by the recipient. Turning now to capital gains. The taxation of chargeable gains will depend on the location of the property being sold. Turning first to immovable property, for instance, land. The chargeable gain will arise in the contracting state where the land is situated, unless this rule is overridden by domestic legislation, as is often the case. Where the property itself is movable, then any gain will be charged on the permanent establishment, as a first priority, or in the country of residence, where no permanent establishment is in existence. These rules also apply to the taxation of capital. We will now turn to the method of double taxation relief. There are two types of relief here. Firstly, exemption. Under the exemption rule, the income or gain will be taxed in one or the other of the contracting states depending on the rules we have previously outlined, and exempted in the other. This, for instance, often applies to things like property income, capital gains, and business profits. The other method of relief is known as credit relief. This is where the income itself is taxed in both states. A typical example here will be interest, where the interest is taxed in one state on a source basis, but the receipt of the interest is taxed on a person resident in another contracting state. In this situation, one of the states gives relief for tax paid in the other, by the operation of the normal DTR rules. We will now turn to special provisions. Firstly, non-discrimination, as given by Article 24. This basically says that tax paid by foreigners cannot exceed the tax paid by any locals in that country, i.e., where there is a double tax treaty in existence, a foreign country cannot charge UK citizens who reside there any more tax than they would charge a local in an identical situation. Mutual agreements are given by Article 25. Where tax is being charged which is not in accordance with the tax treaty, the taxpayer can apply to the competent authority to sort the matter out with the other contracting state. The 2008 version of the Model Treaty has added a mechanism for arbitration where an agreement cannot be reached. In the UK, of course, HMRC is the competent authority. Consequently, where a UK resident individual feels he is being overcharged either by HMRC or by a foreign tax authority, he may apply to HMRC and they will sort the matter out with the other tax authority. Exchange of information is given by Article 26. This basically means that information can be exchanged between competent authorities. So, HMRC, for instance, can ask another tax authority for information about a particular taxpayer or taxpayers. This is not necessarily confined to the terms of the treaty, but may be a general exchange of information provision. This enables HMRC here to gather information about UK resident taxpayers who are receiving money abroad but may not be declaring it on their UK tax returns. The collection of taxes is given by Article 27, which is a new addition to this particular OECD Model Convention, which was agreed in January 2003. What this basically enables is international cooperation in collecting taxes. Therefore, for instance, if HMRC is owned a pile of tax by somebody who is resident, say, in the United States of America, the US tax authorities will give assistance in the collection of the UK taxes. The rules on exchange of information have been codified and expanded by the Finance Act 2006. Agreements can be made covering information in relation to direct and indirect taxes and the collection of tax debts. Let us round off this session by looking at the final provisions in the treaty. First of all, entry into force. A treaty comes into force when it has been ratified by each contracting state under the normal domestic procedures. Termination is determined by Article 30 of the Model Convention. A double tax treaty remains in force until either of the contracting states gives notice to terminate. This is given through diplomatic channels within 6 months before the end of the calendar year. The treaty will be withdrawn from the start of the next calendar year. That concludes this session on double tax treaties.